Hello, welcome to Sheffield Board Gamers Podcast, the official podcast of the Sheffield Board Games Club. My name is Rick. I'm joined today by Tom Cauldron. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Rick. I didn't know we were official.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah.
I thought we were all amateur. I'll have to take myself more seriously.
And we're also joined by Tom Lovell as well. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Rick. I'm definitely unofficial.
Not even in Sheffield, yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm a hanger-on now.
It's good to have you on, though. Good to have you both on. Thanks for coming on. We're going to talk about some of the games that we've played recently. We're going to talk about Ticket to Ride Legacy, but we're not going to have any spoilers. We're going to talk about it in a kind of vague way, but myself and Tom have been playing that a little bit, so we're going to talk about that. We've got a question of week, question of the week, which is, how did you get into the hobby? So what games did you first play? Can you remember what you first bought? But before all that, I saw that there's a couple of Rainer Knizia games are getting reprints. So we've had quite a few recently. We've had Tigris and Euphrates, Ra has had that big deluxe reprint, which looks really nice. On Kickstarter at the moment, I think it's just funded, it's Through the Desert. I think I played your copy, Tom, a long time ago.
Oh, quite possibly.
Yeah, really enjoyed it. It's kind of like putting pieces out on a board. Little camel pieces, and the pieces are really nice, like little pastel colours, aren't they? Like little.
Yeah, they are lovely. They look very delicious as well. I mean,
yeah,
pistachio flavoured camels, the mint flavoured camels. Yeah.
So that's just funded. So that's getting a new reprint with new artwork and everything. And then another one is Medici. I think this one had a reprint not long ago. Another company did it, but it's somebody else that's doing it now. This one's a bit unusual. I don't think it's coming to Kickstarter or GameFound. I think it's just like a pre-order type thing. But I saw on Facebook that they've got the reprint of Medici with some new artwork and a few extra things. And you can buy a first player token, like a metal coin first player token for 10 quid. So the typical Kickstarter bling coming to it.
Yeah.
I've not actually played that one, but I've heard good things about it. I don't know if you guys have played that at all.
I'm not actually sure whether I played it or not. I think I played several. I mean, Knizia, he does sort of a game and then several things around that game with a similar idea or similar theme.
I think
I played a couple of the other things.
There?
I played a couple of the variants, but not the actual main Medici game. Medici the dice game and Medici Duel and something else, and Strozzi, which is a similar idea.
Oh, yeah, Strozzi, yeah.
If we're on Kickstarter, there's also Arctic Roll, which is a roll and write by Ian Brocklebank, who's often been at the Sheffield board game playtesting.
Yeah, I've tried a couple of versions of that over the years.
Yeah, so that's a very nice roll and write that's funded, and at €5 a pop, it's like, ooh, well worth a peek.
Yes, I could recommend that one.
It is a print yourself, so it is... You back it, and I think you get the files.
Cool. Okay. So, let's talk about some games that we've played then. Shall we start off with a smaller one? I've been playing a trick-taking game called Aurum, I think it's called. A-U-R-U-M.
Yeah. I'd say Aurum, but Aurum. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I don't know. I've not actually played it.
I'll defer to your pronunciation. It's a 3 or 4 player trick-taking game. It takes between 30 and 45 minutes. Designer is Shrish Bhatt. So this is one of those, I think trick-taking games are coming back into fashion again.
Oh, there's dozens of them coming
with
out.
With the deep sea ones and, Cat in the Box and things like that. This is another similar one to those. It's basically like a deck of cards, and there's a couple of tokens in there as well. It's basic trick taking, so you've got numbered cards in different suits, so from 1 to 10, and I think there's 4 or 5 different suits, and you take out some depending on the number of players. So one player leads, plays a number. Before you do that, you bid on how many tricks you're going to win. So it does that thing where you get a hand of cards, and if they're like higher cards, you can say, I might win more tricks on this round, or if they're quite low cards, you can bid lower. And you get points depending on whether you hit that target or if you go over it, or if you're under it, you don't get any points. So you make a bid first of how many tricks you're going to win. Then whoever's leading plays a card, a numbered card. The next player has to play a different suit. So you can't play the same suit. And whoever played the highest numbered card wins. So all well and good, pretty straightforward. But what the twist on this one is the gold cards. So there are gold cards, and the gold cards are trump. So everybody starts off with a zero gold card, and you can use that to win the trick. Even if your opponents have played a 9 or a 10, you can still win it with a gold card. However, you lose the gold card when you use it. And when the trick's done, whoever's played the lowest card, they'll get a gold card from the middle of the table. So it gives you like an extra little bit to think about. Going first is really tricky because you know how many tricks you want to win. You might want to win 4 this round, and you've won 3 already. So you need to know you're winning one, but you need to make sure you lose the other ones. But you can see other people have got gold cards, so you can kind of work out if they want to use it, and you can see their bits as well. It's really clever. It's really interesting. It is very similar to Cat in the Box. It's kind of like a basic trick-taking game with a little bit of a twist. Once you get your head around it, it's pretty straightforward. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. If you like something that's quite a traditional feeling and that sort of anybody can play, yeah, it's a good one to check out. This.
That does sound interesting. That does sound like a nice little twist. I can almost. Trick taking is great because there seems to be so much you can do with just a little twist, and immediately you go, "Ooh, how would that affect it?"
Yeah, it is.
I like it. The fact, as you were saying, with trick taking, most of it's fairly intuitive.
Yeah.
So.
I can remember the first trick taking game I played. It was that Deep Sea one. What's it called? The crew. That's it.
The crew.
Yeah, the crew. Yeah. Mick and Deep Sea. Yes.
Yeah, and I'd never played a trick taking game before, so it takes a few rounds to get your head around. I could win this quite easily, or I can lose it quite easily by playing certain cards that you've got in your hand. But once you got that down, yeah, it's pretty intuitive and flows quite well.
There is a skill learning how to lose tricks as well as not just winning all the time, because a lot of the traditional card game trick taking games, you want to win as many as possible, so there isn't skill so much in losing. It's just win. So keeping to a number adds that extra level of skill that you don't often have in your traditional trick-taking card games.
Well, I'll go for another fairly traditional style card game. At the club the other day, I was introduced to a game called Chimera, which is based on the Chinese game for 3 players exactly, called Beat the Landlord, which is you're trying to get rid of all your cards. You've got a hand of cards. The landlord has more. The other 2 players have, I think I've got like 11 in the hand or something, and the landlord's got like 14. So it's a bit harder for them to get rid of it. But if they do, then they get more points. It's a ladder climbing game, which means that someone leads and puts down some set of cards, like I might put down 3 of a kind or something, and then the next player has to put down a better of the same sort, like a better 3 of a kind, or pass, and then keep on going until somebody has put down the best 3 of a kind, and then they will lead the next one with a different set of cards, which might be a pair, or 3 of a kind and 1 of a card, or a pair and 1 card, or 2 of these, or 4 of these. This is the thing with traditional based card games. They all seem to have lots of different fiddly little rules that you've got to remember. I mean, they all interact really interestingly, but I get the feeling with all these things that sort of developed from gambling games, essentially, is that a lot of the rules are put in there specifically so that the first time you're in there and betting money, you think you're winning, and then someone goes, "Ah, no! Well, in this particular case, you put down this and this, and that beats that." And you didn't know that because that's another rule that they hadn't told you. But yes, we had a few little hands to that, and it was working very nicely. It's just thinking through how things interact to try and get rid of your cards. Like, I can definitely put down a pair, and I've got loads of three of a kind, so I can definitely win that one. But then I'm left with these useless single cards that I'm probably going to get beaten on, so I'll be stuck with them and never get to lead another trick. Or I don't think it's called tricks, is it? But anyway, never get to lead another hand. So how to actually work out through the puzzle how to get rid of your hand is a little bit tricky.
Yeah.
And it worked quite nicely. You'd probably have to play it, similar to games like TQ or something. You'd have to play quite a few games just to get sort of meta game going, so you know, you get the feel of what sort of things are coming, going, and how to get the additional points along the way. Because it's not just getting rid of your hands, there's some cards that get you points. So you might not have won the hand, but along the way you've collected some cards that have 10 points or 5 points or something. Mm. And then there's other combinations that you're left with at the end if you've managed to get out that get you even more points. So yeah, over a whole evening of playing that, you might accumulate a lot of stuff. And you can see how this evolved from gambling games, because you could very easily think you're doing well, and then suddenly someone turns around and says, "Oh, right, now you owe me £500.
Yeah, I think a lot of those kind of traditional games like cribbage and poker and stuff like that, they're it's that similar kind of thing, isn't it, where if you play it a lot, you get to know the rules inside out, and you know all the edge cases and things like that, whereas if you just come into it and playing it once or twice, you're going to get fleeced and all your money taken off you.
Absolutely. I'm definitely never going to play any of these for money.
You're going to go home without a shirt.
Yeah. And similar to that, I've also recently... Well, Paul just decided to randomly get a Hanafuda deck. Okay. Now, have you heard of this?
Bless you.
Yes, thank you. This is a traditional deck of cards in Japan and Korea, I think, are the main places where they have it. And they have sort of standard... sort of suits. You get like 12 different sets of 4 cards, so you know each one sort of represents a month, and there's different plants on them, but then some of them are special in one way or special in a different way, like, you know, our sets of playing cards. There's multiple different games you can play with them, and a lot of them are this sort of thing where you have to remember 10 different ways that you can combine these cards to make things.
So
I haven't actually delved into that, but I've just had a look through the rules, and it's that similar sort of thing. Like, you've got to remember that if you've got 3 of the animal cards, then that's going to add count for several points, and but one of these animal cards can count as an animal card, or can count as 2 junk cards, or Yeah, it's going to take a bit of time to get my head around that one, I think.
Yeah.
But yes. But it does look interesting. And it's a traditional, standardized design that goes back a couple hundred years, and it's over these over this wide geographic area. They're all playing the same thing. One of them's a picture of some 9th century calligrapher and a frog. So, yeah, that's just one of the cards that is always in this deck.
I bet there's some really nice versions of those decks, even if you're just collecting them and looking at them for the artwork. And
I expect so, yeah. I mean, obviously we've got the cheapest possible one. But they're not cardboard playing cards like you'd think. They're sort of a bit thick tiles with sort of textured back.
Oh, okay.
And fun fact, a company that started off as a manufacturer of Hanafuda cards back in the 19th century was Nintendo.
Ah, okay. So, yeah.
Well, no, as you've mentioned it, I've had a quick look, and looking at some of these Hanafuda cards, you also have them that if you lay them next to each other, they create a scene.
Oh. Yeah, I'm not sure mine do that. But yeah, they're just variants. Yeah, variants on traditional sort of images of plants on mine. But anyway, I don't know how varied they go, but yes.
That sounds cool. Well, I look forward to hearing how you get on with those.
Yeah. Paul just randomly said, there's a little package there. Okay. Yeah, it's just because she'd been reading some Japanese novel in which some guy had been trying to teach his son about some games for Hanafuda, and she thought, I'll get some. I don't know how big a thing it is in Japan, but...
Having a quick look, there looks like there's Disney versions, Mario versions as well.
So
instead of this 9th century Japanese calligrapher with this story about encountering a frog, there's a picture of Mickey Mouse.
Encountering Mario.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yeah, well, I wonder whether if you compared the sort of the modern for want of a better word, well, I suppose actually Mario is, in a lot of respects, Oriental culture in some respects, being that it's Nintendo origins, but I can't remember who the designer was. So, but yeah, a lot of the Western influences and other things, whether they've kept the principles of the Hanafuda and just added things on.
Yeah, I expect a lot of it sort of kind of set in stone, a lot of it, you know, like trick taking. You've got trick taking, but there's some slight change to it. But it's always still got the same core to it. But yeah.
Yeah.
I expect it's similar, nice, a lot of these.
Yeah, the ones I'm looking at here.
That's a little rabbit hole that's interesting.
Yeah.
The ones I'm looking at here don't have any numbers on or anything. They're just the pictorial ones of, like you said, the month that they're around or what they represent. So, yeah. You'd have to know all the suits, wouldn't you, and what order they go in and things like that.
Yeah. And the 8-part bridge, you've got to remember, is one of the animal cards, but doesn't have to be an animal card or something. Anyway, so, the traditions that have grown up. Apparently, there was a whole sort of cat and mouse thing between the Japanese government and playing card manufacturers, because they kept on trying to ban it. But then they'd put out some sort of slightly different design to get around the, it's not that deck that you banned, it's a totally different deck. So it ended up with a sort of abstracted standard. Yeah,
it's like our games where dice were kind of frowned upon, and then, I've got a spinner in this one now, then. And then you tried to ban spinners, and, now I've got a teetotum or whatever it is. Okay, shall we go on to the big game then that we played? Big as in expensive and big.
Weight.
Ticket to Ride. Legends of the West. This is the legacy version of the Ticket to Ride game.
Now, you guys have played most of the way through this, but I'm yet to play this, so don't spoil anything for me. I will jump on you.
No, we'll keep it all. We'll keep it all secret. If you've played any of the other legacy games, so if you've played like the Pandemic One, in fact, I think it's the same designer, isn't it? Rob Davio, who does all those ones. Yeah, Rob Davio. It's
Alan R. Moon, Rob Davio, and Matt Leacock.
He's the guy who did Pandemic and all the other ones, isn't he?
Yeah.
So if you've played the Legacy Pandemic or any of the ones, you'll probably guess what's in this one. It's a campaign game where you sort of start off with a small map, and then you kind of play Ticket to Ride, and boxes get opened, things get added, stuff comes in, stuff goes out. Apart from that, it's Ticket to Ride. Yeah.
So does this start with the first game is basically Ticket to Ride and then it changes? Or have they got some variant of it to start with?
No, it literally, if you play Ticket to Ride, that is the core mechanic, where you pick up two train cards, or you place the train cards in order to lay down trains on the available routes, and you can pick up tickets, and it's about filling tickets. The big thing with the legacy is that instead of how much you score, you get amount of cash. And so you gain cash at the end by completing routes. You also accompany. So I've been the green company. So whenever I complete a green route, I get money. So you can get money in other ways as well throughout the game. But the winner of the game has got the most. And that can be getting money whilst playing the game, money from tickets, and also if you've got rid of a set only have a limited number of trains left at the end, then that also is a certain amount of cash. And the legacy bit is after each game, you put your bank slip in a vault, and once you've played all 12 games, you'll take them out and find out who's won the campaign compared to each individual one. That's definitely not spoilery, is it?
No, that's okay. Unreasonable.
So how many players, I think it goes up to five. You can play this up to five. How many players are you playing with, Tom?
Three of us.
Okay, we're playing with two. And I'll tell you one of my problems we've got with a game with two players. Each time you play a game, at the end of it, you add some more stuff in, you open a box and you add more things to the rules and things like that. I think with two players, they don't really go out as quickly. So things come in and things go out, but we're just adding more and more stuff. So we've played 10 out of the 12 games so far, because we've got a couple more to go. and we've found that there's quite a lot to remember and quite a lot of rules that we need to try and hold in his head. And we do, we are forgetting things at the moment. We are forgetting to do certain things or remember, oh, this needs, yeah, when you do this, you need to remember to take one of these cards and things like that. Do you find with three players that you haven't got that problem, or are you finding that as well?
Mostly we're fine. So this was our Christmas. Christmas Day comes and we open presents, and that was one of them. Hmm. And family had been asking us beforehand, and it was, you know, when can we see you over Christmas? You know, what are you doing on Christmas Eve? What are you doing on Christmas Day? We had family over Christmas Day. My wife's parents at one part, my mum at another part. There was a, you know, crossover. And then I was like, what are you doing Boxing Day? And it's a case of, we need family time. Hmm. I.e., we are getting up, we are having cooked breakfast, and we played our first game while still in our pyjamas. Then we decided to play our second game once we'd got dressed and were actually, you know, and the third game, and I think we got through four games on Boxing Day.
Right.
It might have been three games on Boxing Day and then a couple the day after, but basically, out of the nine games we've played, the first five or six were played during the Christmas holidays. And then we've
same for us.
We just went hard and fast, early doors.
Yeah.
And we loved it. There was both my wife and my son, when you finish the first game and there is a little box that you're instructed to open.
Yeah.
And you open it, not knowing why it happens, not knowing why you did certain things, and immediately you go,
That's really cool. Yeah, the first big surprise at the end of the first game. Yeah, it's really good.
And you'd gone, if I'd have known that, I'd have done things differently, but you didn't.
Yeah.
And that was one of the best feelings of playing a game, when you go, well, that's very cool. And then there's not much box opening because, again, not particularly spoilery, one of the biggest differences from Ticket to Ride is there are newspapers stuck in the train deck. And so when you collect a newspaper, there is an event deck, and that has an impact on the game. And as I said earlier, some of it can involve you getting more money or less money or doing other nasty things. And at the end of each campaign game you play, the loser gets to ditch one of the events they don't like. And so it's changing because each year you add some more in, and some of the other boxes add events in. So that really changes up the gameplay, as well as many other weird things that happen. But there's always things coming in, and they work for a bit, and then things go away. So it's not always add, add, add. Sometimes it's add, and then it gets taken away because there is a mechanism for, right, you've had enough of this, this bit finishes, which I like. And with three of us, I think that is the right minimum number, because there's enough awkward positions later on in the game where you're going, right, I don't want to go this way for reasons, I want to go another way. And I can imagine with two people, you're not forcing problems. But with three, there is a case of, well, they're not affected, but the other two are. If that makes sense, where if you're free, the other person isn't. At least this way, you can do things to affect one or both or another thing. So I think that's a good mix. I suspect four or five, again, it would get a bit tighter and would also work well. It is something that is thoroughly enjoyable. We looked at it and went, whew, it's a lot of money, £100. Well, it's not quite. I think it's maybe we got it for £80 or something. Mm. But it's a sizable amount of cash. And then we went, actually, how many hours have we spent playing this? If we were to go to the cinema as a family, how many times could we go compared to playing this? And we went, actually, we'll have spent more time playing this than we would have done hours in the cinema for the same price. So in that respect, you'd look at it and go, it's a lot of money. But actually, for us, we've gone, no, it's definitely been worth it. We've had family time. We've been talking, interacting.
I'm sure I've read somewhere. I couldn't find it, though. I've been looking for it. I think at the end of it, you've got a unique Ticket to Ride game as well that you can play.
You have the unique Ticket to Ride.
I think less
game,
so yes. The pandemic ones, because they were kind of done once you'd finished the campaign. I think that was pretty much it. But I think I'm sure I've read somewhere that this one you can carry on playing it just like as a normal Ticket to Ride game.
The bit that you and I know that changes throughout the game, how that gets incorporated at the end, I can imagine how it could work. But yes, from what I have read, it is able to be unique, and I can understand why. It is a huge board.
It's massive,
isn't it? I'm not sure if it's bigger. I think it is bigger than your typical Ticket to Ride or Ticket to Ride Europe or any of those.
Yeah.
So it is a stonker of a game in terms of board. And I think you end up with, 56 trains. So we've got far enough that we know that, the longest route going from one edge of the States to the next. And no surprise, because I think people could predict it, you will get tickets to go from East Coast to the West Coast. That's kind of really self-evident. It's just, I'm not going to tell you when that turns up.
What do you say there's a plot to work through, or is it just the games develop?
There is story.
There is definitely story.
Yeah. And there are things that link up, and things that you are trying to do. So we've just unlocked a region, and there is a very distinct next game. You are trying to achieve this because it is a one-off achievement.
Right.
Other times there have been, you're trying to do this over a series of games. So there are things that are a one-off, things that are a little bit longer, and there are things that you can really do that affect your strategy. So my biggest complaint, which is a bit like a lot of Ticket to Rides, are in one of the previous games, my wife rinsed the two of us because she happened to have lots of long routes, just by chance, when she got her tickets, lots of long routes that overlapped. And that's my biggest complaint, is sometimes by just luck, myself and my son, we both played decently. We both got some of our best scores, but we got utterly rinsed because my wife just got particularly lucky.
Yeah, there is a bit of luck involved, isn't there?
That is the one unfortunate element. Whereas with Ticket to Ride Europe, you've got mainly shorter routes and everyone gets one long route. And the way this works, and I understand why, but it could possibly do with almost having two decks in terms of ticket cards.
Yeah.
One which is, this is the high ones and this is the short ones. Because if you are playing someone who has got four long routes, and just by sheer bad luck, you've got short or middling ones that you've just got no way to compete other than, well, I've just got to risk it and spend time picking up more ticket cards. But that's an action. And the person with the linking long routes is just going, well, that's happy days for me.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you've done the same, but there is a catch-up mechanism at the end of each game. So whoever's the loser gets an extra little bonus. We actually, in the middle of the campaign, Tracy was losing quite a few games on the trot, so we kind of gave her a couple of those bonuses rather than just one, and I didn't take any. So we kind of balanced it that way, and that got her back on track. But that's at the end of the game. That's not like in the middle way, what you're talking about with the tickets. It's, between games, that was.
And there are things as well that you will be doing for the game that help you campaign-wise, that don't help you win the game, but may help you win the campaign as well, which are really nice.
Yeah.
God, I'm really finding this awkward because I want to say how awesome it is and trying to be really careful.
Yeah, it is tricky. One thing you mentioned about the price as well, you said that it is quite a big expensive box with lots of game in it, but it is full of stuff. The trains themselves are unique. Yeah. Each like colour is a different shape, so you get unique train pieces. And I guess if you're a fan of like the normal Ticket to Ride, you can put those into your Ticket to Ride game when you're finished, or I'll use those as extra pieces as well. But it's a big box full of lots of stuff, lots of cards, lots of boxes to open.
And when you get the special Barbie ones, when you go past the Oppenheimer area.
Is this spoilers? The nuclear explosions.
Yes, Barbenheimer took over Ticket to Ride. No, we're joking.
They're cashing in on the social phenomenon.
No, being serious, and actually, the production values are really, really good. Whenever you're opening something, you're going, these are well-crafted cards. The artwork at every point is really nice. It might not be cheap, but it is value for money, unquestionably.
Yeah, we didn't have any problems with the rules either. The rule book's pretty good. Well laid out and clear.
Yeah, and when you add new rules as well, they're there in sticker form. And so you just come up and put it sticker, and it says, right, add these stickers in this place.
Yeah.
And where they've got the stickers as well means you're not accidentally stumbling across them either and going, oh, I found something else. You've got to specifically look for them. So, yeah, I like that rather than other ways which could be implemented. It was well thought out in that respect.
I think for us as a two-player game, yeah, I think I would have preferred to play a three-player. I think it would have been better with more players. It does work, but...
One thing I will say is there is a mechanism to add people in campaign-wise as you play along, but I think whilst you can still play the game with them, unless you're playing regularly, you know that just turning up once or twice, and yes, you can join in, but actually, campaign-wise, you're not going to... You've got to play all of them.
Yeah, you need to stick with the same group, really, don't you? People can drop in and drop out, but...
Well, as long as you've got... Yeah, I was going to say, as long as you've got someone go, right, you are the Yellow Company, you are the Red Company, that's fine, but you can't go, well, actually, Yellow Company's not played for two games. They're just going to be out of it campaign-wise, I think. You know, maybe some of the early games, but once you get sort of mid-game onward, they can't miss many games, because they'll just not have the earnings for each game to even compete.
Yeah, I don't think anything else I need to say about it. I think we've covered it pretty much there.
I'm looking forward. I'm hoping they do another Legacy game.
Yeah, definitely.
I hope this does well enough that they do another Ticket Tried Legacy. We've enjoyed this so much as a family.
I've just got one more question before you finish off with this. Is it a definite number of games, or does it vary? Is it definitely going to be like 12 games, or do you not know quite exactly what it is?
Fixed, isn't it?
It's
fixed, and it says on the back, and it tells you how many trains for this year. So it goes year by, you know, it jumps forward a set number of years each time.
So you know exactly what you're getting into when you're starting a campaign.
Yeah.
You know that it's going to be 12.
Yeah. Okay.
It's not like the pandemic one where if you lose, you play it again. It's up to 12 if you do really badly.
Up to 24 if you do really badly, 12 if you do it really well. Probably somewhere in between. Yeah. This is exactly 12. Okay. Yeah, fine. There's another couple that me and Paul have played a couple of Legacy games. We've played King's Dilemma and Betrayal at House of the Hill Legacy. Betrayal Legacy? Oh, yeah. Anyway, we may end up getting this one as well to play with the same group. So, yeah.
If you don't like Ticket to Ride, I think if you don't like the randomness or if you don't like the way it plays out, this isn't going to change your mind. It's just...
Yeah. If you don't like Ticket to Ride, this is just...
Don't do this.
You'll hate it.
Okay.
Yeah. Don't do it if you don't like Ticket to Ride. If you do like Ticket to Ride, it is Ticket to Ride with sugar and cherries on.
Yeah.
So.
Excellent.
What?
Okay, so that's Ticket to Ride. No spoilers. I think we did a lot on between us. I think we did all right not to give anything away. Difficult though it was.
You revealed that there were stickers in it.
Yeah.
I think, that's not really a surprise.
Yeah. Well, it's when the president gets assassinated halfway through. That's the big problem.
Yeah. And the laser beams on the trains.
Yes.
Anyway, let's talk about a non-legacy game. What's your next one, Tom?
I'm just going to quickly mention this because I have only played 1.5 games of this, but I thought it was quite interesting. It's possibly one of the more interesting games that I've come across for the first time and recently is Seasons, and this has been out for quite a few years. We should probably work up exactly how long ago it came out, but I haven't played 12. It up until now. 12 years, yes, that sounds about right. And I've been aware of it. I've wanted to play it for a while, but a couple of weeks ago, it was at the club. I think it was Ben that brought it. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he showed us how to play Seasons, and yeah, it is an interesting game. It's a card game where the resources you're getting in order to play cards come from a set of dice. So each season, each round, you roll a set of dice and pick one of them, which gives you something. It might give you a couple of tokens of different elements, or it might give you the ability to take another card, or it might bump your track up, which is how many cards you're allowed to have played. Because that's one of the economy things in the game, is you can play cards, but only up to a limit, and you have to keep on expanding that limit. So at the start, you can't play any cards, but by the end, you'll have like 10 or 12 out in front of you. But in order to do that, you've got to get the dice with the right symbol on it. So yeah, it's the cards do interesting things. There's a lot of there's quite a lot of interaction between them. It was a little bit more chaotic than I was expecting when I first started playing it. As in, I looked at my card and thought, oh yeah, that I can do that to do that. Okay, if I manage to get that at first, then I can do that. But then I didn't realise that other people were going to play cards that suddenly wiped out some of your cards, or suddenly everyone else lost loads of points or something. I think it's possibly greatest strength is also its greatest weakness, in that it builds up quite a lot from simple beginnings to at the end you're working through a lot of different interactions between your cards. So if I do this, then that gets me 5 more tokens which I can spend on that, and then I can do that, and because I've got 5 of this type of card, that gets me 5 times loads of points, and it sort of explodes a bit, which does mean that you've got this big feeling of you're building up into sort of a really powerful engine, but also there's a possibility of AP, analysis paralysis. You're staring at all these possibilities and wondering what to do.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a really neat game, and I think I'm going to try more of it. I played one game at the club, and I'm halfway through a game on Board Game Arena as well. So yes, because it's on there, and I'm playing a turn-based one.
Yeah.
On that. But yeah, it's an interesting game. I was aware of this a while back as the first game that I could think of that credited not only the designer of the game, but also the artist that they'd used. They've got equal billing on the box, which was an unusual thing. I think a few more games have done that since, giving big credit to the artist.
It's a really beautiful looking game, isn't it?
It is a beautiful looking game, It's great.
The dice are big, chunky, coloured dice that are fun to roll. The artwork's really good. The player boards are really nicely colourful. It's really bright.
Yeah, there's different art on all the different cards. It's great, yeah. There's a beautiful sort of circular board in the middle of things as you sort of gradually move through the seasons, which give you different dice to roll as well. And that's a nice nice centrepiece to it. It's quite a nice-looking game, yeah.
And the dice are weighted towards more of the tokens as well, so you can see that you're in the summer season at the moment, but soon coming up autumn, and you're going to get more of these kinds of tokens in the autumn period, so you can work towards
that. In summer,
you
get more of the fire tokens coming up, and yeah, that sort of thing. Yeah, and each season, there's also different amounts that you can get for transmuting these tokens into points. So in summer, the water ones are worth 3 points, but the fire ones are only worth 1 point, or something like that. I don't remember if that's exactly right, but yes. Towards the end of the game, you're just trying to turn as many things as possible into points, and then all the cards are worth points as well. And I think there's more to explore here than I've experienced so far. I'd like to play it a few more times, I think. Have you guys played this one?
No, having had a look, it's not one that I've played before. It looks interesting, but no, I've not.
I think it did reasonably well back in the day, but it sort of never sort of exploded into a sort of phenomenon, but it was always a popular game, I think.
Yeah, I enjoyed it, same as you, Tom. I liked all the combos and working out, you know, the most efficient way of using the dice, drafting the dice, picking which tokens you wanted for that particular season, things like that. How I'm going to spend these most efficiently to get the most points. It was a good fun game, yeah. I think you play it over 3 years, not real years, but like game years, where the
clock you've got a little bit of control over
time to it as well. It's not
a little bit of control over how fast you're moving around this board.
Yeah,
because whatever dice is left has a number of pips on it, and that's how far around you move. So you could decide to go slowly or make it go a little bit faster if you're wanting it.
I never bothered with that. I was just more bothered about getting what I was getting. I wasn't bothered about what was left over. But yeah, it's something else to take into consideration if you think you're in a good position and you want to sort of rush the game and make it, you know, go a bit quick.
Just a little bit of a nice little bit of design there.
I did. So I've played it a couple of times in real life, and I've played it on Board Game Arena as well. It's one of those games that loses it a little bit on Board Game Arena, just because if you're losing that physical connection with the game, you're not picking the dice, you're not rolling the dice, you're just looking at the cards on the screen and sort of picking the tokens. It kind of loses a little bit, I thought.
Yeah, possibly. Although it does have the handy thing of you can hover over a card and see exactly what it does.
It does all the bookkeeping for you as well, doesn't
it?
BGA, yeah. Which is handy. Yeah. But yeah, it's definitely a good game. Yeah, definitely want to be. Yeah, we'll have to try again.
So, second Christmas Day gift was my son's, who's a small, as far as he's only 11, Doctor Who fan. And so we got Time of the Daleks by Gale Force 9.
I'm interested in hearing about this, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really nice game. So it's cooperative. So what you're trying to do, you're trying to reach Gallifrey before the Daleks on Scarrow do. But as you go through, there are certain events that happen. Actually, the Daleks appear to impede you, but they're also taken from the show. On your turn, you've got a choice to either visit another Earth location. So, like the Third Doctor, moving to different locations on Earth is easy. The TARDIS can do that without problem. And so you've got Earth present, Earth past, and Earth future. But because it's Earth, there's no difficulty. Alternatively, you can go to an off-world location. And at that point, you roll the TARDIS dice. And if it shows up with a TARDIS, you turn over two locations and you get to choose which one you go to, and the other one goes back to the bottom of the stack of locations. Or if it's the question mark, you turn over the top location and all you get to do is choose which time frame, because each location has two time zones on it. So you've got a choice of four if the TARDIS is behaving, or a choice of two if the TARDIS, because it's Doctor Who, misbehaves. And at a location, there is a task you have to undertake. Before you choose the location, the task is face down, and the time zone has certain icons in which you need to complete the task. Sometimes it's one, sometimes it's two, sometimes it's three from the time zone, and then when you turn the task over, it adds some extra symbols. So you're trying to complete these tasks as both the Doctor, but with assistance from your companions. The companions enable you to change your black dice as the Doctor, so that there are six skills, and the black dice, it's one of each type. The companions and the equipment that the Doctor has enables you to change a black dice for red, blue or green, and the red dice has three of one icon, two of another, and one of a third. So you've got a greater probability of succeeding set tasks. The more dice you've got, I think you get a set number, but you can add a few on, and different bits of equipment help. Roll the dice. If you've got certain things that enable you rerolls, either equipment or companions, great, reroll them. Certain events, you cannot either use a reroll or a choose option, which different companions or equipment help you do, and that's it. But if you fail, then dependent on where you are, there is a, if you fail, this is what happens. And sometimes you get zapped by the Daleks and you have to regenerate. And so regenerating means that the numbered doctor that you are, you become the next one you have available in your set. So you start off with the first doctor, the fourth doctor, the 11th doctor, and the 13th doctor in the box. And we've got the expansion to include the 7th and 9th. Because each doctor has got their own special TARDIS console. So what their unique thing that they can do, but they also have certain preferences for companions and other things. So, for example, if you're the 11th doctor, I think you can choose Amy Pond. And if you've got Amy Pond, when there's the opportunity to recruit other companions, it's really easy to recruit Rory. If you're the so there's links as well that enable you to choose companions rather than randomly get associated as well. So thematic, it keeps the theme really well with the game. You get, at each point you're going, yeah, I can understand where this is coming with Doctor Who lore. It's not just the pictures. How it plays does feel very Doctor Who-y.
I think the problem with the Doctor Who games is that there's absolutely loads of them. And I think some are probably better than others, shall we say. So I can never decide which ones.
Some are definitely better than others.
So I can never decide like which ones you know you want to pick up or which ones you want to play. But this one sounds like a good one. Is it more geared towards gamers, do you think, rather than just like a mass market one that you see in the supermarket or something? Is it more of a
this is Gale Force 9, so yeah, they are very much not the supermarket one. Now we've got, what was it? We do have one of the, this is mass marketly produced supermarket one, which isn't the worst board game I've played, but it is a simple game with the name Doctor Who stamped on the front. You're paying a bit for the IP because you do have the Doctor Who imagery and stuff, but it is a move about the board with some Doctor Who kind of elements in there.
Yeah.
And it's not totally not Doctor Who, but it is, to use the phrase setting and theme, it is a Doctor Who setting. This game is very much a Doctor Who setting, but the way the game plays as well, it really does be a Doctor Who theme. You can reskin it, and it won't be a Doctor Who theme, but they incorporate the setting into how the game plays well, that I think it's fair to say it is a Doctor Who themed game rather than a Doctor Who setting game, which the other one is a pile of toss and it is.
Sounds good. Shall we move on to question of the week then?
Let's.
Yes, before I'm worried about other games.
So our question of the week this month is, how did you get into the hobby? What games did you play first? Can you remember what you first purchased? Things like that. So for me, I was big into video games. I still am. So I had all the consoles and the computers and stuff like that. And I think this was probably about 10 years ago now. Sheffield University were doing like open days, like open learning days. And they were doing it on video games. So you could go down, you could learn how to program, how to do the artwork, stuff like that. And I think it was run by some of the students, and they get like extra credits, you know, for hosting these external things that anybody can go to. So even though I'm not part of the university, and you know, anybody can turn up and sort of learn about computer games. So I was going to a couple of these like once every month or something. And then one time I went down, they were saying, no, we're going to talk about game design in this one, and we've got some board games. So they'd got Ticket to Ride, they'd got Flux, and they'd got a weird Freedom and Freeze game called Three Commandments. So they're the first three.
That is a weird game.
They're the first three games that I played. Yeah, so I think that was about 10 years ago. And then I played Ticket to Ride, and I thought, yeah, that was really good, that. And then didn't think anything else about it. And then started thinking, oh yeah, I could play that game again, or I could buy something else, I could get something for myself, and then started looking at like videos and things, and then, you know, as it does, the dice tower pops up and you start watching top 10 board games and things like that. And the first game that I think I bought was Pandemic. So I'd obviously seen reviews of it, so the dice tower guys talking about it, and thought, yeah, that'd be perfect for me and Trace to play, like on an evening or a weekend or something. And then, went from there, basically. I found the club, did a Google search, turned up at the club and started playing there. And then, been playing more or less every week since then. So that was obviously we'd be playing like games when I was a kid. We played Scrabble and Monopoly and stuff like that. We had Buckaroo and, you know, kids' games and things like that. But it wasn't until sort of, I guess, fairly recently that I kind of got into the hobby games and sort of start collecting and playing them.
Yeah, I think I'm probably fairly similar. I mean, obviously, I think you have to have this sort of foundation of having, you know, lots of games when you were a kid.
Mm.
So, yeah, I think I played quite a few when I was a kid, you know, lots of Downfall and Othello and things, you know. Mm. Or possibly Reversal. No, it was Othello. And then, you know, it was just sort of, that was just what you did as a kid, and then later on it was just a long period of not really playing anything, just wasn't something you did. Played a few games at university, suckered into going along to some games evening because they had a video game that I wanted to see, but they had lots of, then they said, okay, over in that corner is Mortal Kombat, but here's Go as well, you know. So, you know, it's a bit sneaky. That was a maths club, I think. So so I ended up playing a couple of things there, but yeah, really actually getting properly into games was about 12 years ago, I think. And it's all Paula's fault. That's my partner. He had a few old games from when she was a kid that said, oh, we could play through these before we get rid of them. We were doing a lot of eBaying and selling stuff off of all old stuff. But we had a few games of those. And she started sort of finding things in charity shops. And he bought some games that he knew. Like, you know, there was a one from the 60s, also called Go, but a different Go. This is Go the travel game, not Go the ancient Japanese war game. But yeah, there's things like that, you know, mass market things. But then she also picked up a game that neither of us ever heard of called, and it was in German as well, which is weird. It was Durch die Wurst, sorry, not Wurst, Wurst. It's not through the sausage, it's through the desert. And this was
the same one we were talking about earlier.
But this was I think it's the original printing.
Right.
I mean, obviously, I didn't know that at the time. It was just this weird game. And, you know, someone had scribbled something on the front because there was obviously, it must have been a gift to someone. And, you know, played through it. And this kind of was totally different to anything we'd seen before. Yeah, it wasn't like roll and move or anything. It was just like, oh my God, here's the possibilities. I've got to think through the possibilities here. And, oh God, the consequences of putting this camel here. Oh my God, the agony.
Yeah, that's similar to me when I first played Ticket to Ride. Yeah, similar feeling of like, oh, this is something new. This is something interesting. Yeah.
It was weird. Yeah. Mm. And that was kind of eye opening at what games could be that I hadn't really realised before. And yeah, and we just went from there, discovered other things. I mean, my sister had, we'd already had a few games with my sister of Carcassonne. She had a big box version of that, so with lots of different expansions, including the catapult. The silliest expansion ever. Where you're firing meeples onto the board. So we had sort of, were aware that games were around there, but on sort of discovering this, I had a sort of proper look and then discovered there was a shop on the Wicker called Patriot Games, and I went in there and what's all this stuff? Yeah, they've moved a couple of times since then.
Yeah,
now on Mary Street.
Yes,
getting bigger and better all the time. But yeah, gradually discovering more things. Bought War of the Ring, and then discovered Will Wheaton's Tabletop, series on YouTube, and
I think
sold a few more games.
Yeah, I've seen a few people talk about that. I think that brought a lot of people into that.
That was a big thing, yeah, because it was really sort of geared to sort of showing people what there was. It wasn't a show for gamers. It was a show for everyone involved about games. Yeah. That sort of showing just it was just playing through in an entertaining way with people you might have heard of. Or probably didn't most of the time, but yeah, it was that was a really good show. Just people enjoying games, and you go, oh yeah, I'd enjoy that game. I'll go and get it.
Yeah,
and there was the Will Wheaton the Wheaton effect that was talked about. Any game that was featured on his program suddenly sold 10 times as much. Mm. It was a big thing for a while. That started buying more games and discovered, went online and discovered that there was a local board games club and went along. And now got hundreds of them.
I think it's funny how I think a lot of us as kids probably played games because that's what you do when you're a kid, isn't it? You play games.
Yeah, it is.
And like for some of us, it kind of carries on and we still carry on doing that. But I guess it's a similar sort of thing with like Lego, for example. I know, like Lego now, it's a big thing, and a lot of adults do it, and they buy the big, massive sets that are quite expensive. There's no way.
You're making me feel like I haven't grown up.
Yeah, but it's funny how it's like one particular thing that's kind of carried on for us. What about you, Tom? Where did you start?
At least 30 years ago, as a kid with my brother, I think HeroQuest counts as that bridge between your typical family game and the hobby games. And so I played that with my brother, as probably not a surprise to anybody who's heard me on the podcast. I fell into miniature games. And so around my 13th birthday, I think it was, I got the Epic 40K, so Space Marine, the board game with lots of little tanks, teeny tiny tanks and infantry and a Titan and other things. And then that progressed to Warhammer 40,000. And so I played that in my teens and even when I went to university. So I've been collecting miniatures and playing miniature games in one way, shape or form since my early teens. But I also, when I came to Sheffield, so that was 2002, I was introduced to Magic the Gathering. So played a bit of Magic the Gathering back then, and I was also introduced when I was doing my PhD into role-playing games, but also someone played Flux with me and Catan, or Settlers of Catan as it was known then. I think the first game as an adult that's more of the hobby game, I was bought by my brother. Name has gone out. Arkham Horror.
I thought you forgot a new brother's name then.
No. I know my brother's name. It's Tim. So, you know, that one's a really easy one to remember. Tim and Tom.
Yeah, that's pretty easy, yeah.
Yeah. Not quite as confusing as Tom and Tom, is it, Tom?
Not quite, no.
No. Right, so, yes. Cool. Arkham Horror was the first one that was sort of bought for me. But there might have been a few others. But I've been collecting miniatures games for so long that, plus I've got a number of role-playing books. And I was having a look when we were talking. I think 2014 was the first hobby game I backed on Kickstarter. So it was the tail end of 2014. So I've been backing independents or the hobby-type games on Kickstarter for nearly 10 years. And yes, I still buy Lego sets myself.
they're really popular. Yeah, some of the
really
big
good
ones with lots of pieces. Yeah, they're like collectible as well, aren't they? They can be worth quite a lot of money.
Well, yeah, I've got a Wall-E, and I've got a Lunar Lander. And yes, I haven't grown up, but you know, I don't care.
You mentioned HeroQuest when you played that. I never really played any of those kinds of games, like HeroQuest, Dungeons & Dragons 1, the Dungeon 1, Dark Tower, or anything like that. I never played any of those when I was younger.
Oh, well, I've played the version I played with my brother with my son when he was younger. So, you know, we now play slightly, you know, a Dungeons & Dragons dungeon crawler, which is a little bit more advanced, but is it's a co-op where everybody's playing together, whereas HeroQuest was very much a 4 versus 1, where as the dungeon master, you had the map and you were revealing things and playing things, but you knew that actually you were there to facilitate the other 4 to enjoy the game. So I much preferred, as an adult, playing that with my son and his mate as the heroes, and I could be the evil wizard dungeon master, because they enjoyed it that way. And that was so much better than when you're kids and you're going, right, I want to be this, I want to be that. It's like, right, you've rolled, you know, your job to be the dungeon master. So as as a parent, fantastic. Game-wise, there are better, but in terms of as a kid, it was fantastic. The miniatures are still solid, you know, and I'm talking about the one that came out in the 80s. If you looked at them now, you'd go, yeah, okay, there's better, but these aren't crap. They're good miniatures. The cardboard scenery that you came in, it was good. It's just something about the game flow. It could be improved upon. Not hugely. There's a few tweaks, but buy it, you know. So it's not a bad game. It's still a good game. It just, there are bits where it could be a bit better. It's not a bad way to sort of get bitten by the bug.
Yeah, and it's still in print now. You can still get those kind of games, can't you? HeroQuest and the expansions and stuff. I've seen them.
Yeah, but that's a reprint. That came out, I think, in
it's the new version.
About 3 years ago or something. It was back HeroQuest, buy it for 100 quid. And that's the thing. If you said, right, you've got 100 quid, do you want to buy HeroQuest or do you want to buy Ticket to Ride Legacy? It's Ticket to Ride Legacy. It is, for the price, as much, if not more, stuff, and it is a better game. Full circle almost.
Yeah, so we've talked about games that we first played, and we've talked about games that we last played, so that's a good, good segue of that, though.
Do you think it's different these days? I mean, we've all got into the modern board games over 10 years ago. Do you think, I wasn't aware of it until suddenly trying something randomly and becoming aware of what games could be. Do you think people now, it's more, yes, I know that the games are there, I just haven't tried it yet?
Yeah, okay. I think so,
You just think, yeah, I'll try some games.
Yeah. Tom can probably tell us about where he is, but in Sheffield especially, there's several board game shops, there's Treehouse Cafe.
There wasn't so much when we getting into hobby, I think. Yeah.
But now, people are obviously aware that these places exist, and
it's easy to try it as well. You get, like you say, you can pop into a Treehouse Cafe and
pick games out of the library, if you wanted to try something,
Well, last week,
the library's got a whole collection that people can try.
Yeah, I was going to say, half-term, we were in Bristol, and we were going to go to see a show, and had time before tea, and we popped into Chance Encounters, which is a Bristol board game cafe, and there are families in there. So it was 2-3 o'clock on a Thursday afternoon, families in there playing board games. You could go to Waterstones, you could go, you know, so heck, you can get Big Potato Games. They're things you can get in the works. You can get stuff in Tesco's and stuff. So certain games have become mainstream that were originally what you'd call a hobby game, and they've become more mainstream. And that means that the fringe ones are more accessible, because you then have the more dedicated stores also stock.
Yeah, I think the internet's made a big difference as well. Yeah. Nowadays, you can just go on Amazon and click on basically any game that you want. Whereas obviously in the old days, you had to actually go out and hunt it down, didn't you? Go into a shop and...
Yeah. But,
and actually, you know...
The old days. Kids these days.
I think there is a difficulty, though. No,
we don't have any of that.
I went going into Waterstones, there was a point where it was more a broader range of the hobby games. And now there's a bigger proliferation of games that are linked to an IP that you know.
Hmm.
So you do have the big ones like Ticket to Ride, like Catan, that have been, that people would now say are evergreen, which, you know, at 30 years old, Catan clearly is. But you've got games that are, this is Top Gun, this is Back to the Future, and there's an IP that you know.
Yeah, yeah, Game of Thrones or whatever, yeah.
Exactly, and so you've got countless games that the traitors have used as inspiration of those social deduction, but you'll see the traitors card game or board game front and center rather than Avalon or Coup or One Night Werewolf. They're less likely to be prominent because of the IP. So I think we are seeing a move to IP-based hobby games.
I think IP games are a lot less likely to be rubbish than they were before.
Yeah. Well, that's also true.
Used to be, if you throw an IP game,
stay away from it. Yeah,
but nowadays they're actually good ones.
We played the Alien game, the Nostromo one based on the old film, a couple of weeks ago. That was really good fun. That was a good game.
I've never heard of that one. I think. I mean, obviously there's several Alien, but not quite copyright infringing games. Out there, but this is an actual IP.
Talking about IP games interesting, because I'm going back to Doctor Who as well. My stepmom had a copy of the Doctor Who game back from the 80s. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah. And I knew that my son liked Doctor Who, so took it out and played it. And it was we're playing this once, because, it's a Doctor Who game, but it is basically an IP cash grab.
Yeah.
A bit roller move.
I can't remember. It was a...
You can't even remember. Oh, my God.
Cards were just printed text on them, no artwork.
Give me a sec.
He's going to go and fetch it now.
It's called Battle for the Universe.
I'm Googling it.
That sounds exciting.
Okay. So what you
I'd have bought
got,
that one over there. Yeah.
Okay, you have got four circles. So there's one circle on one side of the board with about 10 spaces on it. And on the left-hand side, you have got three circles, and most of the board has got a bit of background. You know, you've got a Cyberman, you've got a Dalek and other things in dark blue on slightly lighter blue. I mean, you've got the magic recorder, you've got the crystal of Kronos, and jelly babies and other weirdness. You've got a sonic gun, not a sonic screwdriver. And, yeah, it's... And then, in terms of components... you have got rule book is effectively a sheet and a half of A4 on each side. You've got a dozen pawns and some... If you played Monopoly in the 80s, basically the card stock is the same as the cards there for the location. And the artwork is diabolical.
I mean,
there is a fourth Doctor here, which has got a face that, you know, the drama faces.
Why does the Doctor have white hair?
Well, he's basically got this kind of weird stripy thing. He's got a hat on, but it looks like sort of those masks that you have. It's honestly, they have probably paid GCSE art student to do these and got them pissed beforehand. I mean, honestly, it's utterly dreadful artwork. The only thing that...
I'm looking at this picture right now, and yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. That is nothing like... It hasn't even got a scarf on.
No.
He does have 100 inner force and 50 jelly babies, though.
Yeah. So, yes, at least modern IP games... are better than that steaming turd.
Yeah,
I said it wasn't going to be come really a long way since, about I think. Games. Whoops.
Yeah, I mean, these are interesting images to look at.
Yeah.
Anyway, but it's nice to know that there are some good Doctor Who games out there.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm currently watching Doctor Who they've since the BBC put all of them, well, almost all of them on iPlayer. I'm watching it from the start, so
yeah.
I'm still on William Hartnell at the moment, and it's kind of a different program to what it is now.
Yeah, I've watched a few episodes of the older ones as well. Yeah, catching up a little bit.
My son is,
used to be educational.
My son's kind of going backwards, so he's been watching all of the Sevenths again. So he had watched them. A friend when I was in Sheffield is a well-established Whovian and has everything on DVD, and so my son had watched the three series of the Seventh, but couldn't remember them. So he's been going back and watching the Seventh, but also some from the Third, some from the Fourth. So he's been dipping in and out, and so not being sequential, but trying to pick up and watch the others. He does struggle more with the black and white ones. Thank you very much. But on TV, I think it was Sunday, film four had Dalek Invasion of Earth 2150 with Peter Cushing. Wow. So we're watching, I recorded that because he was out. So we're going to watch that at some point and get to see the 60s.
That'll be a bit of a shock.
Yeah.
Bernard Cribbins and things.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Fantastic. Right, okay.
Before we finish off, can I just finish off something? I did a setup earlier on, and I completely forgot to do the payoff.
Go for it.
Okay, so, finally. You remember I mentioned that the first hobby board game we got into was Food of the Desert, and someone had scribbled on the box.
Uh-huh.
About 10 years later, I realised that someone that had scribbled on the box was Rainer Knizia.
He
must have signed it to Desert or something. You know,
he signed it.
Yeah.
Must wow. Have
yeah.
Cool.
So yes.
Yeah.
Took a while to realise that, but yeah. Anyway, that's the payoff.
Right.
So, if you want to have a look on eBay, there's a signed copy of Through the Desert on there, and there's also a Doctor Who Battle for the Universe game.
Yeah.
So fill your boots.
I don't know. There might be a bonfire with that one on.
Tom Coldren, thanks for coming on. Thanks for talking to us and telling us
thanks,
about
Rick.
That. And Tom Lovell, thank you very much. Thanks for coming on and talking to us. Been brilliant talking to you both. We've been Sheffield Board Gamers. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on the next episode. Goodbye for now.
We may start a Doctor Who podcast as well.
Yeah.
Spin-off. All right, bye then.
All right, bye.